Well, good evening. That's loud. As you will have gathered from the passage, it's quite a searching passage to preach on, and I could have really spent the whole week just getting ready for this, in all honesty. But God speaks to us about our personal lives. Not just our personal lives, even deeper than that, actually. Our hearts, our the attitudes of our hearts towards other people. And this passage certainly searches us out in that regard. I do have some points that I'm going to try and make. And the first is that very clearly, God intends his people to be distinct in our sexuality. That there's a distinctiveness about God's people and their sexuality. We're not supposed to just fit in with the world and do it the way they do it. We have a unique way that God has set out for us. That's the first thing I really want to get over this evening. And secondly, marital faithfulness to an unrelated spouse or singleness and celibacy and singleness are the two means by which God has given us to experience and express our sexuality. And then finally, thirdly, these distinctives are not just matters of indifference. They are essential to our survival, to the essential survival of us as a people. If we lose these distinctiveness, we lose our place in the world, and I hope to bring that out from the text as well. So let me just come at it. It's a searching passage, but let me just come at it. I was reading a report produced by the bishops of the Church of England of late, because, of course, they have been enormously embroiled in this debate. Human sexuality is probably the single touchstone debate that is bringing what the church is talking and thinking about into the public domain. I can't think of another subject, really, that has the same profile in terms of what the church might be saying or should be saying and the wider society. This is, so the bishops understandably commissioned a report. This is what it said. What seems unarguable, this was their opening, what seems unarguable is that there is a greater diversity of attitudes to sexual morality at this time than at any other time in the past. That's quite a remarkable statement, isn't it? They say there is more widespread acceptance of wider sexual diversity at this time than any other time in the past. And I suspect they're looking at the past in Britain and the time over which the Church of England has presided, maybe not the whole of human history, but, you know, in its own experience. When polled, two-thirds of the population, when asked, thought that sex outside of marriage wasn't just not bad. Most people actually thought it was good, that it was healthy, that it was beneficial, that it was a useful experimentation and the rest of it. On the subject of same-sex relations, which really don't make up the full body of the text we're looking at tonight, but are there mentioned in this passage, a majority of people, most of whom were from the younger generations, believed that same-sex relationships at least should be endorsed, and many believe they should be wholly embraced. In fact, what's remarkable is how little distinction a lot of young people made in their minds about sexual orientation. They didn't feel it was a choice they had to make. They just followed their impulses whichever way they led, and they didn't feel they had to make any particular choice. They just kind of went this way and that in the exploration of their personal relationships. So we are in a time of social change. And in that time of social change, we can look at the reasons, the big drivers. We're in a day of choice, aren't we? Consumerism, we're drilled to make choices, educated choices, to survey the market, to make decisions, to do what we like, to build our own personal profile. And we're living in times of great protection for personal privacy, legally speaking, where you can essentially, as long as you're not hurting somebody else in the privacy of your own home, you can pretty much do as you please. There's a lot of legal protections for that. Also, things in medicine like contraception have enormously opened up an exploration of what sexuality is all about, because the consequence, the great consequence of sexual relations, having children and all those considerations, have been somewhat lessened and removed, so people can explore sexuality without thinking about, can I afford to raise children, do I want to have children, and the like. And of course, with advances in medicine as well, we've got a situation where people can be cured of diseases that have affected them as a result of a promiscuous lifestyle, for example. And there's a great sense of liberty that's been developed in all these regards. Throw in the mix what's happened since the 1960s in music, in films, in literature, and every other aspect of media, on the internet, on television. We have had an explosion of the sexualization of music, the sexualization of entertainment, the sexualization of leisure and of children and everything else. And media is just pumping out sexual imagery at us all the time. And not surprisingly, our understanding of marriage has been massively redefined in the public arena, and we have a very changeable situation as we stand. 50% of marriages don't end divorce now. It's 50-50 now whether a marriage will survive. Most people are not getting married. Lots of people just cohabiting, and everything is changing. We're in a time of flux. And I think the Church of England and ourselves as Christians have been brought by these changes to a kind of decision very similar, actually, to the sort of decision that the Israelites were facing in the period that we're looking at. In chapter 17, verse 7 there, if you've got the book in front of you, in Leviticus in front of you, you'll see that they were experiencing a challenge within their own sort of sexual attitudes. And you'll see in chapter 17, verse 7, there were people going out into the forests or into the woods or into the wildernesses, and they were sacrificing to what are described as goat idols. And I talked about that a little bit last time. And a decision had to be reached by within the community. God led them to a decision to outlaw this practice completely and to put a stop to it. I made the point last time, I hope perhaps if some of you were there last time will remember, that these goat idols, if you sort of, one of the modern incarnations of this is the image of the Pan, you know, with the goat legs and the little horns, the fawn, the playful creature, expressing, you know, nature and its urges and its bestial side, the expression of what you feel, do when you like, when the moon is shining and you know, the wine is running. It's sort of that spirit that would lure us out into the wild, that we should let our hair down and go wild. That is very much what we're talking about there, and implicit in that wildness is infidelity, the breaking up of the ordinary bonds and relationships that exist, and just letting loose, doing what you like, and going crazy, and abandoning yourself. Now, obviously, it's within the context of a religious event, perhaps maybe once a year or once a month or whatever it might be. But on that time, at that place, you can just kind of go crazy, and you can do what you like. This chapter, chapter 18, it's not an accident that chapter 18 follows swiftly after this outlawing of these practices that's been described there in chapter 17 and verse 7. In fact, I believe what we have here is an expose, an enlargement of the kind of things that were going on at these, I think the Romans used to call it bacchanale festivals, you know, these festivals of wine, women and song and of general abandon. And we see the kind of things that they had been doing in Egypt, the kind of things that they were still doing in Canaan, and that the Israelites themselves were kind of partially involved in to some extent, and they were drawing a line under it. The fact is that these sort of indiscriminate orgiastic practices were sanctified by the offering up of blood. In the same way as we've seen that atonement was made for the sins of the people, so as they offered up blood to these nature gods, as the blood was offered like an atoning sacrifice, it sanctified their behavior. It kind of gave them a permission slip just during the context of this situation. You can go crazy because it's covered by the blood. It's covered by the blood. In short, they concluded that the blood that they were offering gave them a license. And under the atoning blood that they made, we see that in chapter 17 and verse 11 that God is very clear that the reason he's given the blood to offer in sacrifice is to make atonement. But they are using this atoning blood instead of to cleanse them from sin and forgive them of their sins so they can go on in holiness and righteousness and get right, they're using it as a license to do what they like, when they like, how they like it. And I think maybe this is the difference between, maybe it's a bit of a subtle difference. Once saved, always saved. You've heard people say about that. Once saved, always saved. As if somehow there's no responsibility or relationship set up between you and God. He's done something for you and now you can just kind of live like you like. Whereas the real teaching, I think, is, it's a bit old-fashioned English, but the final perseverance of the saints, which teaches that what Christ has done for us and giving us his Spirit enables the Christian to persevere and press on and pursue holiness and keep going right to the end, which I think is more a helpful way of understanding this. You see, the thing is that what we see in chapter 17 is that there were certain occasions, certain times, where they were allowing themselves this kind of license and giving themselves this bit of permissiveness to do all sorts of things. And the problem with this, because this is an attitude of thought, you know, some people believe that if you forbid people from doing things, if you draw a line in the sand, what happens is that they just get repressed and frustrated. And then as a consequence of that, there's an explosion of some sort. So the secret, the answer, is to just undo the pressure valve once in a while, let it all hang out. You know, this is a kind of social valve. It eases the society in some way. But the problem is that once you loosen that valve and you experiment and you try something, actually, rather than, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. But actually, one thing leads to another, and what becomes sanctioned in a very careful space then actually ends up becoming your norms. And your society gets transformed, and your society gets changed. You know what people say? I was drunk, they say. I was drunk. They did it just the once. I was drunk. As if somehow the fact that they were drunk, they have no moral responsibility for the fact that they got drunk. It's as if they've got a license, because under the aegis, while I was under the influence of this spirit, I have atonement. It's like I'm covered. It's like when people say, I was only joking. It was only a joke. They say something that's really distasteful or disquiet, but they say, I was only joking. And as if somehow that writes off an allowance, because under the aegis of this temporary license, that I'm now allowed to do something that is wrong. And people do that. And the trouble is, the more you do that, the more you write yourself these little licenses, one by one, it gets bigger and bigger. That's the saying, isn't it? Give them an inch, they take a mile. And that's just the way things work. You see, chapter 18 is setting down laws. Setting down laws. If you've got the NIV there, I think the phrase it uses there is practices. At the beginning there, but the word is actually quite strong. These are laws. It's not marriage laws. These are not marriage laws. This is laws governing the expression of human sexuality. What kind of impulses you can pursue, what kind of impulses you can't. It's very clear. It's very black and white. And it's clearly, as going back to chapter 17, verse 7, stamping out what is called there prostitution. And by prostitution there, it's not what we think of in the modern sense of prostitution, maybe, although that is similar. Because in that arrangement, sexual license is granted because a payment is taking place, and because it's all between adults and a payment is taking place, it's somehow that this makes it all right. It's not all right. It's not all right. And no amount of money or religious sanctification or I was drunk, or we were just messing about. None of those things justify the acts. And this prostitution that's described there in chapter 17 and verse 17, where they were going out to these other gods and they were prostituting themselves, exposing themselves, letting go all of their sexual inhibitions, is what is being stamped out and addressed in chapter 18. Now, which version were you reading there from? NIV. Yeah, the 84 NIV. If you look at, maybe you've got a King James, one of the expressions that's used there in the translation is uncovering people's nakedness. You know, the phrase to uncover somebody's nakedness. And so it's not just simply the participating and taking part in all these things that's being stamped out. Actually, the thing of uncovering, looking, participating voyeuristically is just as much a part of the problem as participating yourself. So you can see where some of what I'm saying is going, I suppose, about the modern prevalence of pornography, for example, as well as all the other things that are going on in our society at the moment. People keep maintaining, that if we can sort of ritualize these things that are taboo in some way, shape, or form, it'll stop our society from becoming repressed. But this passage tells us that if we carry on down this road, it will destroy our societies. The fabric of our societies will get undermined and will lead to social collapse. And if you're not convinced by this passage here, if you go to Romans, just turn over to Romans chapter 1 for a moment, and verse 18 through to 32, there's a painful essay there written by the Apostle Paul on this very subject, commenting how as people ignore God, ignore God's word, ignore the knowledge that they have that there is a God and he has a right to their lives, so he hands them over to this kind of licentious living. And the effect of that, as you just scan down there with your eyes, the effect of that is the unwinding of their society, their social collapse. It just ends up in confusion and destruction. So God loves his people. That was Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through to 32, I was just commenting on there. God loves his people. And because he loves them, he wants to preserve them and keep them. And because he wants to preserve them and keep them, he deals with this very private matter of Israel, their sexuality. And their sexuality is not to be like that expressed by their neighbors. Not by the Egyptians who they used to live amongst, or the Canaanites who they are going to be, I suppose, neighbors with shortly. They are to be different. And as we see in verse 3, these are not just customs that he's laying down. These are statutes that he's imposing upon them as a people. And in verse 4, it makes clear the reason why he's imposing these things is that so they should stand out, that they should be different from the people around them. And as you go into verses 5 and 6, you realize that this distinctiveness is a matter of survival for them. If they don't follow these laws, they will die. It will lead to their extinction. Their existence, their survival depends on them disciplining themselves, being different and standing out in a world that lives and does things very differently from themselves. So there's my first point. The sexuality of God's people is to be distinct and not sympathetic. They're not supposed to look around at the Canaanites and the Egyptians and say, what are they doing? Well, let's take our norms from them. You take your norms from God. Now, let's get down into the detail. Verses 1 through to 18. In verses 1 through to 18, you'll see. Now, I'd be the first to admit that if you were to listen to Christians talking in the public forums about human sexuality and God's perspective on human sexuality, in the main, what I'm hearing at the moment is diatribes about homosexuality. That seems to be the number one subject. But the overwhelming substance here is about incest. Verses 1 through to 18 is almost exclusively, those first verses, sorry, from verse 6 onward, is dealing with the subject of incest. And clearly the reason it's having to be dealt with is certainly because there were examples of this practice amongst them. It was happening. You know, you don't act on something if there's no, without smoke, there's no fire. So it's very interesting as well that the phrasing of in the Hebrew there, no one shall approach, you see it in the NIV, but it's thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. It's just like the Ten Commandments. The phrasing of it, the structure of it, is exactly like the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not. It's very, very strong. And just like all those other things in the Ten Commandments are found and experienced in all human beings, Jews, Canaanites, Egyptians, and others, the difference is that God is moving against these things amongst his own people to purge them out, to purge out murder and lying and all these other things. So what we see there is this is obviously being experienced within their own community. Think about their own father. Who was the father of Israel? It was Abraham, wasn't it? Do you remember who he was married to? His half-sister, Sarah. So this was something that was not just them. This was something that they'd experienced in their own history, in their own background. Now, it's clear that Abraham was married through the agency of his father, Terah, who was an idolater, and it was part of the idolatrous practices of the pagans he lived amongst, and that was what he was given as a child. That's what they were raised with. And only later he heard from God and was converted, but he remained married to his wife, Sarai. And there were all sorts of complications and difficult. But if you were to look in Exodus chapter 6, verse 20, you'd actually find there in one of the genealogies, there was a man called Amram, and he took to be his wife a woman by the name of Jochebed. And Jochebed was his father's sister. And she bore him two sons. One was called Aaron. The other was called Moses. So they themselves, Moses, who's writing this book, grew up in an incestuous family and knew something about this from personal experience. He's not casting stones. This is something he knows about. And he's the one who the Lord moves upon to write chapter 18 and verse 12, which says, "You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister," which is exactly what his father had done with his. So this is touching their lives. It's amazing how many of these laws actually touch upon Moses' own personal life. They're going to change the culture of even of their own family. So easy, isn't it, that the norms of your own family become the kind of things that you pass on. But this is taking objective truth from heaven. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We want to see things change here. We just don't want to just perpetuate what we've grown up with. And what you can see is very clearly that the mention about the Canaanites and the Egyptians is that the difference is in the Canaanite and the Egyptian societies, these practices you're reading about were all right. Evidently, he's telling them, not like they did in Egypt, not like they're still doing in Canaan. In Canaan, in Egypt, you could do these things and you could get religious sanction and approval to do so. Do you remember the big exhibition of Tutankhamun? Do you remember when all his regalia came to England, to London? This incredible gold. He was married to his sister. His parents were brother and sister as well. So at the very highest levels in Egyptian society, it was shot through. Incest was normal. It was a way of keeping it all in the family. Keeping it all in the family. And the Greeks who came later, we always think of Cleopatra as being an Egyptian, but of course she was Greek, and she was put there by Alexander the Great. She's one of the descendants of Alexander the Great's generals, etc., etc. She married her brother. The Romans thought it was all right. Caligula, that dreadful man Caligula, had relations with all three of his sisters. This was at the top senior echelons within the society, Romans, Greeks, Egyptian, and Canaanite societies. Seems this sort of thing was acceptable. It was acceptable in those situations. And things are changing in this country too, aren't they? Things are changing in this country. Quite interesting. So we have now a change of law about homosexuality and marriage and the like. But it's quite interesting that a legal case has been launched about the legalizing of consenting adults to pursue incestuous relationships. Well, it hasn't become legal now, and some people say, well, what about all the genetic defects and so on that can be consequent upon these sort of things? And the legal answer coming back is that all manner of adults in this country are free to marry, even if they know they carry congenital diseases themselves, and it's left on their own moral conscience to decide to whether they have children or not. Why can't we? So legally speaking, it's very hard to argue against. Norman Tebbit, not a politician you'll find me quoting very often, but tongue-in-cheek, said the other day that he thought that time would come in the not-too-distant future where he might marry his son and avoid paying inheritance tax, conflating both the new laws on homosexual marriage and the possible new laws for legalizing incest and bringing himself a tidy sum in the process. Now he was speaking tongue-in-cheek. But it just seems rather Egyptian, doesn't it? It seems rather Canaanite, doesn't it? It's subtle, and I'm sure in their societies it seemed just as subtle and just as normal as it does to many people in our society at the moment. And people's view on incest changes all around the world, but in the main, most societies today actually do outlaw it. They're just a bit different on the fuzzy exteriors about cousins or not cousins and so on and so forth. But generally speaking, there does seem to be a stand. But the fact is, despite the fact that there are laws all around the world, there are still fathers and there are still siblings who are abusing these laws and breaking these taboos. And that is just a fact in this world. And it's coming out into the open in a big way, isn't it, of late? Some people have said that in this chapter here, it's kind of strange in the whole list, nobody mentions here that the abuse of daughters is mentioned in this chapter here. But I'd like to just, for anybody who's read through it and thought, hang on a minute, it doesn't say anything about daughters. In chapter 18 and verse 17, it's very clear, as far as I'm concerned, you're not to have sexual relationship with a woman and her daughter. So if you're married to somebody, your daughter, that's your daughter too, isn't it? And that outlaws that completely. It's depravity. It's depravity. That's the phrase there. In fact, in the United States of America, 268 million people living there, as many as 20 million people are known to be victims of incestuous abuse in one way, shape, or form. 20 million people. So great is the extent of this. And it doesn't matter whether they have consent or otherwise, as far as Israel is concerned, chapter 18 says, absolutely no. Absolutely not. And I don't know about you, but I thank God for operations like Operation Yew Tree that is actually beginning to get a lot of this stuff out into the open, and I'd like to think that some of this gets rooted out of our society because it's been going on too long, it's been given too much cover, and it's about time things changed. Verse 19 to 23, only later does it actually open up the subject to other areas, like approaching a woman during her menstrual cycle. And I suppose what's being said there is that the person is trying to justify the practice to themselves. They say, well, she's not going to have children, so, you know, as if somehow that would make it all right. Or then they turn to their neighbors. Well, what about, okay, if you don't want me to do it with my own family, maybe I can do it with somebody else's family. No. No. Or maybe I could have a relationship with somebody of my own sex because, you know, there's not going to be children that way and so on. No. An animal. No. No, no, no. And then this little verse there about verse 21 about giving your children to Molech. Well, if she does fall pregnant, you know what Molech was? They just gave their children, their infant children, to this god and they just burnt them in the fire. Well, you know, if she falls pregnant, we won't try and keep the baby. We won't confuse things. We'll give it to Molech. We'll deal with it. We'll put it away. No. No, no, no. This is closing the door, every door, on all form of license, isn't it? All form of license. They might have been acceptable amongst the pagans. And, you know, it's incredible. You even read the stories of the gods, some of the Egyptian gods and the Canaanite gods and the things they got up to. Their own sexual practices were pretty hair-raising. It's not surprising that the people followed in their footsteps. And the Israelites had been impressed by them. And they had been influenced by them. And they had been touched by these things. And the idea that God's people in the world are somehow hermetically sealed off from all this is a nonsense, isn't it? We're in the world, but we're not supposed to be of the world. We're supposed to be different. We're supposed to be different in this very important and deeply personal way. It wouldn't surprise you that a God with whom you have a personal relationship has an expectation about how you live your personal life. Because he lives in our hearts. Not in a book on the shelf. In our hearts, in the most intimate place. So intimacy is crucial in our relationships with God. Somebody said, oh, Christianity is all about do not, do not, do not. Nobody can have any fun. Who is left for Israel? There's God. You can have a relationship with God. You can know God. You can have fellowship with God. That's something. That's something. Not anybody else can say that. You can know God. And yes, there's also the subject of a spouse here as well. But let's put that aside for a moment. There's just the possession of your own body in dignity before your God. You can have that. You can have that without it being prostituted. You can have integrity. You can have holiness. You can have holiness. I mean, we have to mention marriage because obviously in God working out his plans for our life, it was there at the beginning, Genesis chapter 1 verses 26 to 27 or chapter 2, 18 to 24. There are these relationships that he already set into motion. For those of the people who come into it, there's this complementary relationships. But the idea that if you're in a relationship with one person, in a monogamous, exclusive relationship with another person, that you don't have to exercise any self-discipline in that relationship. You're dreaming. Some young people, they think, oh, I want to get married because then I want to let my hair down and go crazy and do what I like in the context of marriage. Marriage is not like that. You learn to love somebody else, respect somebody else, and understand their needs and so on and so forth. It's complicated. It's a balancing act that goes on for the whole of your life. It's not always easy. I'm not trying to say, oh, marriage people have got the hard, you know, thick stick. You know, that's not what I'm saying. But self-control is just essential for life, for Christian life, full stop, married or single, otherwise. You have to have self-control. And that is really what is being taught here, to control yourself. And that is never something that you kind of just sign away for any reason or at any time. In fact, you know, if you look into 1 Corinthians, let me just touch on marriage one more time. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verses 4 to 5, talking about the marital covenant, I suppose. It says there, the wife's body doesn't belong to her alone, but also to her husband. That's quite something, isn't it? To give up rights to your own body and entrust them to somebody else. And likewise, the wife to her husband. Sorry, the husband, the wife's body does not belong to her alone, but to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. You are learning to share. Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time so that they may devote yourself to prayer and then come together. You have to sacrifice yourself. You have to sacrifice yourself if you're going to make a marriage work. So this distinctiveness that's set out here is the distinctiveness of celibacy and self-control, or self-control as expressed in marital faithfulness. Not to a member of your family, and I want to just touch on that. You have to branch out a bit further than that to an unrelated person to make your spouse. Because that forces the relationships to branch out across society, doesn't it? I've kind of made the joke once, and I'm kind of going to one congregation, and it was in a very remote place, and I looked around, and they all look very alike. But we're to branch out. We're to go, aren't we? Go into all the world. We're to form relationships and branch out. And these laws caused the people of Israel to form a kind of covenantal web of families meeting families, new families, reaching out, touching, creating social compacts with people right out across the nation. Which means that the inheritance which they were getting, the land that they were getting, wasn't ever going to be held and monopolized by a little clique of people who interbred and intermarried and kept all the power and kept all the good places amongst themselves. They shared it. So there's a mutual sense of ownership. This is our land. This is the land that God has given us. What happens to you matters to me. We are family. Rather than the Egyptians, where there was just one aristocratic clique, and everything belonged to them, and everybody else is just gnawing and gnawing in hunger and hoping for a little crumb from the table. That's not the way it's supposed to be in Israel, because inheritance is right at the heart of all this. Because in the end, like it or not, at the heart of all sexuality, there is procreation and children and family. It's there. It's an unavoidable issue. And this is about their futures. It's about their families. About their children having a sense that this is my home. These are my parents. These are my uncles, that their world is clear. They know where they stand. They know what they own. And so they can take possession of these things and grow up straight. And what we're reading in 24 from 30 is a failure to do this will result in a national disaster. National disaster. That expression is probably one of the strongest expressions you're going to find anywhere in the Bible. The land vomiting the people out. Just finding it so repulsive that these things should be going on the terra firma, on this bit of soil. It's so disgusting, so defiling, that the soil literally just goes, go away, leave. People get very exercised, don't they, about the way Joshua entered into the land of Canaan and the campaign that was carried out in the land of Canaan. I think this is part of understanding what life in the land of Canaan was actually like, what family life was like in the land of Canaan. It had gone terribly, terribly, terribly wrong. And the sad thing is, instead of understanding that and repenting from that, they were defending that with their lives, to carry on living like this with their lives. And so a terrible confrontation ensued. So these laws are there for their welfare, for their own good. Now we know that our society is changing. It's amazing, in a survey, the UK, in all the westernized, industrialized nations of the world, is named the most promiscuous country in the westernized world. What's happened here? It's kind of curious, isn't it? What's happened here? 6% of our population, I'm really not focusing on this quarter, but 6% of their population in the census say they are not heterosexual. 6%, 1 in 20, or thereabouts. And I think that's a small part of the incredible promiscuity that's taking place. The voyeuristic promiscuity that's taking place on the internet on a massive scale. For the first time, we're actually seeing the government saying they're going to try and do something. It seems very small. It seems very late. But they're trying to cut and curb, at least against some of the worst excesses of this on the internet. It is disgusting. It is absolutely dreadful what's going on. These are people's lives. These are people's lives. And yet, at the same time, while they're trying to do that, You only have to listen to the music and watch what's on television. This is a sex-mad society. It's obsessed with sex. Sex sells. And everybody's been ramped up and excited and all the time. You can hardly walk down a street without being presented with a billboard. And yet, when a person in the public eye has an extramarital affair, everybody stands there going, "Oh, did you hear what so-and-so and so-and-so did? It's so twisted, it's so perverse." We have to be different. We have to be different. Our very survival depends on it. Branching out, strengthening relationships, being different. Because in this world that we live in, that difference will be noticed. It really will be noticed. It will stand out. Just as far as the New Testament is concerned, let me just say this. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 3 to 5, I'm closing. It says, sexual immorality, it's probably commenting on this sort of thing, and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you. That's what you call zero tolerance, isn't it? Zero tolerance, as is proper amongst the saints. And this is interesting. Let there be no filthiness or foolish talk or crude joking. Kind of interesting, isn't it? Seems like, again, I was only joking. As though certain situations where we can grant some license. I didn't actually do anything. I was just talking about it. It's not helpful. This is actually quite hard for people. Everybody's trying to live this out. It's hard. With God's grace, we know help. But it's hard. These things, according to Ephesians, are out of place. But instead, let there be thanksgiving. For you may be sure of this, that everybody who is sexually immoral or impure or covetous, is in fact an idolater. It's part of another system of religion, another practice of religion, which doesn't come from our God and has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. So, when we're straight, we need to repent, don't we? And prove that actually we are indeed God's children. Let me just read that last verse in chapter 18, verse 32 in closing. Because this is the challenge of the passage. Keep my requirements. Do not follow any of these detestable customs that were practiced before you came. And do not defile yourselves with them. I am the Lord